Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great cast for you this week. Unfortunately, James couldn't make it to the recording, but we're going to be talking to a returning podcast guest about his upcoming tabletop game. So please welcome back from Peterson Games, Sandy Peterson.
Hello, all.
Hey, Sandy, it's great to have you back on.
Thanks.
We were just talking before the podcast that Sandy is working on a number of upcoming projects. And we are, for those of you listening to this, we are recording this just at the tail end of March. So if things go accordingly, I'm sure we'll be talking to Sandy many times throughout 2017.
Well, it could be.
But for tonight, we're going to be talking about the board game designed around the Orcs Must Die franchise and the challenge of converting a video game design to tabletop and kind of what your plans are for developing it out further. And for those of you listening, we will hopefully have either a cast or a live discussion about Cthulhu Wars later on this year. But for tonight, it is about Orcs Must Die. So, now for those of you listening, we've talked about the Orcs Must Die series before, but I guess my first question for you, Sandy, is for the folks listening to this who may have missed out on the board game, could you talk a little bit about what it is?
Certainly. So, what the board game, Orcs Must Die, has the same basic principles as the computer game, mm-hmm. which is... There are armies of orcs pouring through these portals into your fortress, and they're trying to run through it and go through this rift that you're defending at the far end of your fortress. You are the heroes who are going through the fortress, laying down traps to try to slow down or stop the orcs. There are you fight them, you use special abilities, you cooperate, and generally try to thwart the orcish invasion so they don't destroy your rift.
Okay.
The game uses miniature figures to represent the enemies and the heroes both. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty much the summation. I mean, there's a whole bunch of other features of it. You have hero control cards, and you're drawing these special upgrades that you're getting, or gear. You try to increase gear and stuff. So
do the players get to play as the orcs, or is it just cooperative play?
Well, there's actually two versions of the game. There's Orcs Must Die, The Order, which is where you play humans and dwarfs and elves and humans and their allies trying to thwart the evil monstrous minions. And then there is Orcs Must Die Unchained, in which you play orc and monster heroes that are trying to stop humans and their allies and pet and tame animals from breaking through your rift. So it's exactly parallel, except instead of trying to fight orcs, you're fighting like crossbowmen and human soldiers, you know, things like that. Tame grizzly bears, that kind of event. And then you can actually, if you own both games, you can put them together. And then one group of players can play the orcs, and the other group of players can play the humans, and you each have a fortress, and you're invading the other guy's fortress and fighting, and he's invading yours, attacking you, and you're trying to defend your fortress, and usually you have some guys on offense and some on defense as you both go back and forth to the fortress. And so, in other words, when you're in the enemy fortress, you're trying to escort your minions up to their rift so they can get through and damage the enemy rift. And if you're in your own fortress, then you're trying to thwart and, you know, stop that from happening. So it's we call that the rivalry mode. And you can play with up to 8 players doing that. And it's, that's like the ultimate way of playing the game, at least in terms of investment of time and mental energy.
Cool. Now, as we're going to talk about, you're working on the plans for an Orcs Must Die 2 board game, and that Kickstarter will be coming out in like April, May, right?
Yes, we're doing an expansion. Orcs Must Die did well enough for us as a product, and that we're very excited by it, and we want to expand it a little bit. So we've added some new heroes, some new enemies, a new type of defensive mechanism called the Guardian, and so forth. So.
All right.
That's what that is.
Cool. And we'll talk a little bit more about the Kickstarter probably later into the cast. Now, talking more about Orcs Must Die, the first game, I guess a question I have for you, Sandy, is Like, how did you approach, I guess, getting the license or deciding to build a board game around Orcs Must Die? For those of you listening, I know the original developer, I think they're still working on it, is Robot Entertainment. Did they kind of like approach you with the idea, or did you approach them? Or?
From 1997 up till 2009, mm-hmm. I actually worked for a company called Ensemble Studios.
Ah, yes.
Now, Ensemble Studios had a bullet put through its head in 2009 when I didn't leave. It was like everyone in the entire company was laid off, right? But by Microsoft in its wisdom. So what happened is that everyone in the company kind of scattered to the four winds, mm-hmm. and the largest chunk of players went to a company called Robot Entertainment. So the people at Robot were mostly my former coworkers and friends from the days at Ensemble Studios, which we all got along really well. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing that happened was that when I left Ensemble Studios, I went to work for Southern Methodist University as a professor, and I taught game developers how to make video games. Well, Robot, when it needed new personnel, it frequently hired people from Southern Methodist University, mm-hmm. from the thing that I taught. So, like, the people at Robot are like my friends and former students and former coworkers, so we're buddies. Well, when I was doing Cthulhu Wars, since I used to have game after game interviews with these guys, mm-hmm. I went to play with them, to play test with them, and we play tested. And after a year or so of doing that, I started being interested in doing a video game crossover. And they were talking about, because they were all mm-hmm. working on Orcs Must Die at the time.
Yes.
And so they said, "Hey, what if like we could do something together? You could do a board game." So I approached their management, who of course knew me. I mean, I used to work for them, right? Mm-hmm. And essentially, I had a huge faction within the company boosting me, trying to get them to do the Orcs Must Die. So they gave me a pretty sweet deal. And then we had access to all their art. And then I could playtest with the guys who did the actual video game mm-hmm. on a weekly basis. So all of these things kind of went together to make it a really good meld. I knew how these guys worked. Those mm-hmm. guys knew how I worked. They trusted me mm-hmm. And so forth. So it was all really well.
Awesome. And one of these days, and for those of you listening, it sadly will not be today, but we definitely need to, like, if you're free or available, to have, like, a look back at, like, Ensemble Studios Keck. So I would love to talk to you about the history of the studio and the Age of Empires series. We talked a little bit about the last time you were on, but, yeah, I would, if you're game for that, I would love to talk with you, like, just a cast specifically about, like, the Ensemble Studios era.
I'm sorry, what was that?
If you're ever, like, game in the future, I would love to have, like, a cast just specifically focus on Ensemble Studios at some point in the future.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, the specific thing that happened with Ensemble Studios, so here we had this company which had never sold less than 1 million copies of mm-hmm. any game that we did, okay, which is, of course, mm-hmm. made us fabulously successful. I mean, at one time, we were... our sales were greater than all the other games in Microsoft's game studios put mm-hmm. together, except for Flight Simulator, mm-hmm. which always has done well. So we were kind of their success story. Mm-hmm. And the reason that we were destroyed, and this may never have been stated openly till now, but what the heck? Here's your scoop. Okay, what happened is that Microsoft Game Studios in general was not making money.
Yeah.
Okay. We were making it hand over fist. Okay. And, so they brought in Don Matrick, a former Hatchet Man. You've heard of him. You know who he is.
Yeah.
He came in from EA, and his job was to make Microsoft Game Studios profitable. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you're getting this from the viewpoint of someone that was at Ensemble. So it's possible there's subtleties I'm missing. And of course, it's not like I'm bitter. But actually, I'm not bitter because I love having going on from beyond Ensemble to what I've done past it. But still, I think it was foolish. I don't think mm-hmm. Microsoft enhanced its stockholder value when they destroyed Ensemble Studios, the most of this company. Mm-hmm. So what happened is that, as my understanding, Don Matrick was said, you will get a whole bunch of awesome stock options and stuff if you can turn Microsoft Game Studios around so it's profitable in 3 years. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was his task. All right, which he went to with commendable dedication. Now, in the meantime, us not knowing of this, we said we want to do a like every other game studio in the world, we want to do a massively multiplayer game, mm-hmm. role playing game. And we were pretty experienced in playing them on our own. And obviously, Ensemble Studios was a highly experienced developer. And so we decided we'd do a science fiction one because there hadn't been a super huge successful one. I mean, there's like EVE Online and stuff, but mm-hmm. not, right? And so we did we do it based on the Halo universe. And we put a lot of effort into putting this together. And we kept trying to estimate how much total money this would earn for Microsoft. And we tried to be as conservative as possible based on Microsoft's ability to market, our ability to develop, and the lowest number we ever were able to come up with was $1 billion. Okay? I mean, imagine a giant MMO made by Ensemble Studios, right, for the Halo universe, back when Halo was, like, still super hot. This is like you could play the Covenant, you could play the humans. I mean, it's a great idea, right? Mm-hmm. Well, but the problem is that to do an MMO takes a long time. And we also estimated it would take us 3.5 years to put this out, after which then $1 billion would come into Microsoft's pockets. But from Don Matrick's point of view, in 3 years, the world ends. So his personal portfolio was enhanced by firing us all after we finished Halo Wars, and then not having to pay for the development of the Halo MMO, which came after his time span of he must make a profit by. Mm-hmm. And that was the goal behind getting rid of Ensemble Studios, which turned out to not work out well for so many ways, because we found out they were getting ready to let us go. And the first what happened is that our bosses found out that they were going to let us all go. And the bosses said, oh, well, this, you guys suck. And then they said, well, tell you what, we will let you guys, the bosses, stay to work at Microsoft. We'll just fire everyone else. And to their credit, every one of the management of Ensemble Studios submitted their resignation rather than do that.
Yeah.
And then Microsoft panicked because they realized they weren't going to get Halo Wars out of us because we were, I mean, right? Mm-hmm. Why would we finish doing Halo Wars? They couldn't finish doing it. So then they said, wait, let's make a deal. And then they ended up giving us like this huge amount of severance pay, this extra deal for, and all this money to keep us on until we delivered Halo Wars. So for the last 8 months so instead of being able to fire us after we finished Halo Wars as a surprise, we knew for a year before we were laid off that it was going to happen, and we knew how much money they're going to have to give us. So they kind of took it in the shorts, but I don't feel sorry for them. So anyway, that is the story of that. And, but as a result, the company, I think, although it wasn't great for Microsoft stockholders, it was great for the industry as a whole, because you had Robot going off and doing its own thing. You had Boss Fight Entertainment being founded, going off doing its own thing. You had people from Ensemble scattering throughout the industry and fertilizing other areas with our talent and our ideas and the way things have been done. I founded Peterson Games. So I think the industry was better off. Just, you know, not Microsoft.
Yeah. As we've seen.
But I will admit to some shade and Freud when Don Matrick got axed after failing on Microsoft, the Xbox Live thing.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, Sandy, it's very interesting to see just what kind of sprung out from when Ensemble Studios was closed. And again, that is easily like a podcast in of itself. But yeah, it's again, like, it's one of those very fascinating parts of the game industry that most people don't really hear about. I mean, for a lot, as you said, like, most people don't know what happens to these studios when they close. I mean, when you were on last time, I had no idea when you brought up Ensemble Studios that, wait, you worked there? Like, it's always weird when you find out what games people have worked on in the past. And it's created like a very rich tapestry for a lot of developers.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, Ensemble Studios had its own unique way of doing things, and this way it was very successful for us. Mm-hmm. And so when it got spread to other companies, they also, like, let me give you an example. Okay? So the way that I develop games at Peterson Games, including the Orcs Must Die board game, So Ensemble Studios, the technique was that the first thing we did on any game project was to get it into playing ability as soon as possible, regardless of whether the code all worked, regardless of whether the art was there, get something playable. And you stand in art and you stand in easily broken code just so you can play it. Mm-hmm. And then we play the bejesus out of it, trying to see, like, and then, you know, hope, like, checking for what was most fun, what was most balanced. And then as soon as it was fun, then we, like, we didn't freeze it exactly. We said, okay, don't change any of the things that make it fun. Okay? And now one of the results of this was because of this way, this isn't necessarily the most efficient way to design a game. Mm-hmm. Okay? Because often we take longer to do our designs than other companies because of this method of doing this stuff kind of early on, front-loading everything. But every game we produced, we knew was fun. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to wait and hope people would like it. We knew they would like it.
Yeah.
So all of the games that Ensemble did were hits, as you may recall.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay? And that's not true of many companies. Now, our games took longer to do. They were expensive to produce, but they were all hits. And that's because of that front-loading of playing and playing and playing. Mm-hmm. Now, I took this exact ethos into Peterson Games. And the first thing that happens with one of my games is there's not this long period of development and experimentation. Like, really early on, that game goes on the tabletop, mm-hmm. and it's being played, and that's where the feed comes. Mm-hmm. And major changes in the game happen from that point quite often. And so our games might take longer to do, but I am assured they're all fun when they get onto the tabletop.
Yeah.
That's the part that I am focused on. At least they're fun for me. Mm-hmm.
And that is...
I'm statistic enough to think that if I like it, then some other people will be enough bent like me, they'll like it too.
Yeah, and that is a really good philosophy to have when designing your game, about creating that core... getting that core gameplay loop done as quickly as possible, again, to see where the fun of your game lies. And then once you got that down, then every other decision basically flows from that. And too often we see developers, especially like first timers, go for the just keep changing approach. They never lock something down. So you end up with cases where, you know, you go two steps forward, three steps back. And
well, a lot of developers get fixated on this feature is my baby, and I cannot cancel it. The whole point of the game is to show off this feature. Mm-hmm. Well, I never have that concept. It's like the whole point of the game is to people to have fun playing my vision.
Yeah.
And the people having fun comes before my vision. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean, right? I mean, the vision is part of it, obviously. But yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, I was saying, like as we see, like, their developers, as you said, that they may hold on to an idea, you know, tooth and nail. As you said, it's their quote unquote baby. And there's always that challenge of knowing, you know, when to keep trying to work on something and when you just gotta scrap it. It's just not working. You can't fit a square peg into a round hole kind of situation.
That is exactly the issue that a lot of designers have. Now, part of this may be that a lot of designers, frankly, have done fewer games. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like their first step into board games, or the second or third, or they're trying to get some point across mm-hmm. in their game. They're trying to educate people in some way. And so they find it really hard to what I always consider is that one of the most important things you can do as a designer, or have as an ability, is the power to kill your children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And say, okay, this idea isn't working. Rather than make it work, it's going. Mm-hmm. I can replace it with some other idea. Now, of course, there's the issue of, man, but that was such a great idea. If only it had worked. Mm-hmm. Like, for recently, I was doing a game, a science fiction 4X game of space exploration. And one of the ideas I had for the game was to have these market tracks where the cost of goods would go up and down based on player activity. Mm-hmm. And it was working perfectly, but it wasn't fun. So it was yanked the next time we played. And some people like kind of pined for them because it was a cool idea. Mm-hmm. But the way I do it in my head is that I say, okay, I'm going to take this idea and put it over here on the shelf. And maybe later there'll be a game that idea will fit into. Mm-hmm. And occasionally that happens. I'm able to pull that idea off the shelf and use it in the game, but usually it just goes on the shelf forever. but I can psychologically remove it without feeling bad because I have that.
You have that.
I promise to myself.
Yeah. And again, it goes back
to the game itself as a designer, you know? Yeah.
And it goes back to what you were just saying regarding getting that core gameplay loop done. Once you figure out where the fun of your game lies, it becomes easier to make that decision going forward. Like, if you add something in and it doesn't work, you can say, well, you know, if my main game or if the fun of my game is this and this mechanic isn't adhering to it, then let's remove it. Why should I mess with, you know, what I already know people like?
It's easy to say, but it's hard
to do. Yes, definitely. I mean, we've been seeing, like, for folks listening to this who follow, like, me and some of the videos and stuff I've talked about with games in early access, we have certainly seen cases like that where developers will hold on to ideas, you know, tooth and nail for so long, and that the game just never, basically they're spinning their wheels, essentially, in the mud, trying to make this thing work. And most often, it just crashes. Figuring out the core gameplay loop for your title is very important. And again, we could easily dedicate who knows how many podcasts to just talking about game design fundamentals. But I know that you're busy today, and again, we'll probably have more times to talk throughout the year. So let's go back and focus more on Orcs Must Die, the board game, and then again, we will then move into talking about Orcs Must Die 2 or Orcs Must Die Unchained, that kind of expansion, in a few minutes. So,
okay, sure. So the gameplay loop of Orcs Must Die is kind of interesting because there's the basic loop, which is enemies spawn and are moving through your area, and you are killing them, earning skulls. That's the game's currency, is skulls. Mm-hmm. Each orc has a skull. That's what you pay for things with. And then you're buying traps and gear to improve yourself. Then you lay down the traps to kill more orcs to get more skulls, and you get better gear to be better at killing orcs and get more skulls. And so there's a positive feedback loop that the more orcs you kill, the stronger you become, and then the more orcs you can kill beyond that, and it keeps accelerating. Mm-hmm. Now, this basic loop is contained within an overall gameplay arch, and which is subdivided. The most easy way to describe it is that there are three levels to the game: first, second, and third. And at each level, all of the orcs change their basically become tougher. The enemies become stronger. Okay, and the players get new gear available to them that they can now buy that often usually cost more skulls. And the general way that the game feels when you play is as important to me as the actual mechanics of how it works. Mm-hmm. And the way it feels is early on, the orcs aren't really a threat. I mean, you want to kill them, and they're kind of worried about them, and you're kind of trying to get your game structure set up, where you're going to put your traps, and who's going to be doing what. And they're not that easy to kill because you're so weak that you can't always figure out that you can't always take them down. But on the other hand, they can't really hurt you. Mm-hmm. In the second stage of the game, the orcs can now dish out a lot of damage, but you boosted yourself up enough that you can earn a lot of skulls, and suddenly you are all powerful, and you're massacring the orcs, and you're getting lots of money, and you're getting as powerful as you can really fast. And the experienced player maximizes this because in the third stage, when the final wave of the orcs is really, really hard tough. And those things come down like the Goths upon the Roman Empire, and you are panicked, and they're killing heroes, and they're bursting through your lines, and they're destroying your traps, and it's really scary. And typically, the game ends with a nail biting. Either you lose because the orcs made it through, or with their last wave of guys, or you barely hang on and kill them just in time, which makes for an exciting end, which is always a good thing for me. So it took a lot of iterations of the overall game to get that balance just right so that the game ends with a cliffhanger.
Mm-hmm. And,
it's the most fun. Mm-hmm. So.
And speaking about iterating on, that actually takes me to my next question for you. Obviously, for those of you listening, Orcs Must Die originally started as a video game. We talked about this earlier. And One of the more interesting challenges, and a topic that we've been talking to more developers about, is kind of the interplay between a digital game versus a tabletop or board game. How certain elements can be translated over, some have to be changed along those lines. So, but my question for you, Sandy, is, as you were coming up with the design of the board game, how did you approach things by the fact that you had the actual video game essentially as your reference for making the board game?
Well, I was looking at the video game and seeing that the essential gameplay loop of the video game is the same. You kill orcs, lay down traps, earn points. I don't think they call them skulls in the video game. But you earn points, and then you use that to buy more traps and get more gear and improve your guy. And, of course, in a video game, it doesn't have to do it in the form of singular waves. They can, like, gradually raise up the difficulty throughout the game, right? Which is harder to do in a board game. But that basic loop that they had, I thought that would be pretty easy for a board game to simulate, is like, kill orcs, get money, kill more orcs. And the hard part would come in the details of making it seem balanced, the orcs having the right run of difficulty. Yeah. We did try to feature some elements of the video. Basically, what I did was I went to the video game, and all the things that it had that I thought would be fun or that stimulated me to have ideas in the board game, I took. Mm-hmm. And the things they had that I didn't think would be as fun. For example, one of the features of the video game are barricades, where you can essentially set up a wall, and then the enemies pound away at the wall for a while until they... Actually, that might not even be in the most current version of Orcs Must Die, but it was in the version that they were doing at the time I was doing the board game. But having the enemies stalled in a single place and pounding away kind of didn't seem as fun for the viewpoint of my board game, because in my board game, part of the whole thing for the player is you're trying to move and position yourself, and you can't just stay in one place and pound away. You have to move and go put out fire somewhere else. And so having a barricade kind of counteracted that basic game situation where your guys are just sitting in one place. Mm-hmm. So I still have a thing called barricades in the game, but it functions completely differently. It doesn't stop the enemy's movement at all, right? It just it's just another kind of trap.
That's kind of interesting that you said that, Sandy, about the barrier. So for folks listening, obviously Orcs Must Die features heavy inspirations from the tower defense genre. And for fans of tower defense, we of course know about laning our areas, you know, slowing them down as best we can. And as you said, about keeping them locked in one position, or keep them in one spot for as long as possible to hammer them in. But as you said, that kind of gameplay wouldn't necessarily be as interesting in a board game.
In my board game. I'm not saying there's not a board game it couldn't work in, but it wasn't working in the board game I was putting together. And rather than try to figure out a way to make it work, I just skipped over and said, we're not going to do that. Now, I did have the minions that move fast. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the features of the game, of course, you have the kobolds that run really quick and ignore the traps, or the satyrs if you're playing the orcs. And I could have had them just ignore traps, I guess, and just like, oh, these guys ignore traps. But the kobolds don't ignore all the traps. You can kind of get them. Mm-hmm. It's not as easily. So in the board game terms, it proved really easy to reproduce. I just had them move two tiles instead of one, and the traps don't trigger until after the enemies move. So if the kobolds are moving through a tile, then the traps in that tile won't shoot at them, so they can skip over half the traps. Mm-hmm. And of course, one of the effects on this and the game players, the players hate that, right? So what they do is they try to position their traps so that they don't have them so much in the intermediate tiles, only where they know the kobolds will end their turn. So they're kind of able to bypass this weakness to a slight degree, but I don't mind because it means they're using strategy and they feel smart when they do it. And one of the things I think is really important to a board game, especially a co-op game, is the ability for the players to feel smart. Mm-hmm. They should always feel, if they lost, like it wasn't the game's fault, but theirs, because they made some mistake. They should never blame me for a loss. They all should, right? And the other thing is that if they win, they should feel like it was because they were clever.
Yeah.
They were cool, right? The game didn't help them to win. They won because they were awesome. And then, of course, the more awesome the players are, then the more they will have good feelings about my games, and they will buy them more.
Yes. And
so it's ultimately selfish, but But it uses a good technique to be selfish, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, earlier we talked about how you expand the original Orcs Must Die to feature the orc side of things, and you can combine the two board games or two different games together. In the original version of the Orcs Must Die board game, did a player control the orcs in that?
No.
Okay.
No. In fact, in the version now, when you go out and buy a copy of Orcs Must Die: The Order or Unchained, and you play it, the enemies, the mans, are completely controlled by the game system.
Okay.
Okay. And furthermore, here's the thing. If you buy both games, you have The Order and The Unchained, and you get together with your friends and you set them both up so that there's two fortresses and you're playing orcs against humans, the minions that spawn in the enemy fortress, even though they're kind of your guys, you don't control them.
Okay.
They still move on their own initiative. You just kind of have to follow along with them, which is actually, as it happens, sort of how it works in the computer game too, and sort of, and really for the same reason, because if I was to add to the player's tasks of moving their own character, getting their own upgrades, doing their things, the task of I must also figure out how to move the orcs and the gnolls and the kobolds, then that would slow down play. And one of the features I really wanted to keep in Orcs Must Die is that it is fast moving, never dawdling around, waiting for everyone to finish their turn and finish their analysis paralysis. That every second you're moving along, snap, 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 and you're doing things. And it's like, okay, do your turn. Oh yeah, you're going to be here. And then I'm going to do my thing here. And then maybe there's a brief discussion like, hey, should I fire off my ultimate ability right now? What do you think? And so everything is quick, and moving the enemy monsters in a computer game would take time to do and be not always be exciting. And the same is true in the board game. So that was just that we both have the same goal of a fast moving game, right?
Yeah.
So we did it a similar way, saying we'll just have these simple controls move the orcs. And the orcs are very simple in how they move. They just basically walk down specific paths on the map till they get to the end. And they fight if you're there with them, and they other things I did to make it faster. For example, in the computer game, tracks do damage to the orcs. to simplify matters for my game, because I didn't want to track damage on the minions, because I wanted to have tons of minions pouring through all the time. Basically, the orcs are either alive or dead. They're never damaged.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? So either a track killed an orc or it didn't.
Okay.
And that's how it is. Mm-hmm. Right? Now players take hits and bosses take hits. For a player or a boss, it's not hard to keep track. You just have, a boss card. But the minions, they just take hits. So at one time, the traps rolled dice to kill the orcs, or the orc minions, or the human minions on the human trap, right? And that actually slowed down play enough that I took that out, and now the traps instead, they feel very different from the players, because the traps generate an attack result that's printed right in the trap. It says, this trap makes a sword. And then anything that can be killed with a sword, it will kill. And if the thing takes two swords to kill, it won't kill it. And then if it takes a speed or a brain to kill, those are some other options you can have, it won't kill it. And so you can glance at a trap and say, oh, it's going to kill one of the orcs. And you take off an orc, and then it's very simple and quick to go through. Again, part of my craze for speed. And that came out of the playtesting cycle, because early on, the game was taking 2.5-3 hours to play, and I was dying. I said, this has got to be sped up. And I finally got it sped up by ruthlessly taking away everything that slowed things down. And, as one simple example, in the computer game, one of the things that takes a lot of time is in between waves, you go and you pick what your upgrades are going to be. And of course, in a computer game, that's fun to do. Everyone loves picking through the giant menu of upgrades and spending their money, right? But in a tabletop game, you don't want to wait for each person individually to buy their upgrades. So the upgrades used to be each player would do it on his turn, and then every player would stop and say, oh, should I get an upgrade or not? And I said, okay, there's going to be a team phase, and that's when everyone does all the upgrades, and you talk together who's going to get upgrades. And that'll just – then on your turn, you'll just fight and move, and that's all. And so everyone still gets to ponder the upgrades, but they're all doing it together, looking over the list of upgrades they can get, which who should get this gear, who wants to have the vegetable amending, and they're discussing. And sure, it still takes time, but it's interactive time, not waiting for someone to make his choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, And that is very important, again, about that difference between a board game and a traditional video game. And
right. You don't interact when you're buying stuff, right?
And in the video game, as you said, there's a lot more calculations that go on behind the scenes. The damage of the enemy, damage of your tower, of your traps and whatnot. And that works in the
video games are vastly more complicated than any board game.
Exactly.
Ever
yeah, like, again, like when we were just talking with another tabletop designer a few nights ago, relative to when we're recording this. And we talked about the importance of streamlining the design. Because again, in a board game, you don't want the player to sit through and say, okay, this does 65.3 damage. He has 32 point health.
just make it simple, you know? I agree. And I was actually adherent to this even back in the computer game world, right? Where I wasn't always a fan of small increments. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I was working on Quake back in the day, like we didn't have the Quake damage boost thing add 25% to your damage. It was the quad damage. You were doing four times as much damage. You shoot a guy with a shotgun and they would explode. Mm-hmm. And that made it exciting and interesting, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas you can go and get a piece of gear in Diablo and it'll add 2% to your attack. And in Diablo, that works, mm-hmm. you know. But it's not
the same kind of feel, essentially.
I like few big, exciting mm-hmm. changes, especially in a board game that's easier to put in than a whole lot of little incremental mm-hmm. things.
Yeah, especially when you especially in a lot of board games that have like unique rules or unique systems that can just completely upend your entire game. And that can really add, that can basically just like change the entire scope of the game going forward.
Yeah. As an example of this, and I know we're talking about Orcs Must Die, but I'm going to bring up Cthulhu Wars, because there's a thing that whenever I'm teaching people how to play Cthulhu Wars, it always makes their eyes bug out when they get to it. Is it one of the features of Cthulhu Wars is after units are attacked, some of the units in the area, sometimes all of them, get pained and have to retreat out of the area. Okay, so you have to plan your retreat, where you're going to go. Well, one of the factions, the Crawling Chaos, has an ability called Madness, and when they acquire this ability, for the whole rest of the game, whenever anyone has to retreat, Crawling Chaos gets to pick where they retreat for everyone throughout the game. And when players realize this for the first time, I mean, literally their jaws drop and they're like, wow, that's so cool. And if instead it was like Crawling Chaos can do this for one guy each time there's a retreat or some limited version of it, it just wouldn't be as exciting. Yeah. It's just better to have the big thing. As another example from a computer game, one of the projects I worked on was the Conquerors for Age of Kings. Okay, and I had to add the conquering civilizations. So one of the ones I added was the Huns, and I said every civilization has to have some kind of bonus. So I said for the Huns bonus, they don't have to build houses; they just build up to the limit, no houses. And then there were like, of course, this was a super huge advantage for the Huns. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so there's a lot of complaints of, oh, the Huns are overbalanced. The Huns are this, the Huns are that. And I said, well, I'll try to fix it. And many suggestions came in of, why don't you fix it by having the Hun houses, instead of housing 12 people, 10 people house 12, well, like limit it. I said, no, it's not fun unless they don't have to build houses at all. Mm-hmm. You know, and I stuck with that, and I balanced the Huns eventually using other tools, but the fundamental thing of either you build houses or you don't is the fun part, not having houses that are better.
Yeah.
Right? Which also doesn't make sense if you're the Huns anyway, right? I mean, So I hung tough on this and triumphed, and the Huns, of course, were really popular. They aren't like the big winning game faction in the Conquerors, but they do fine, and they're really fun just because of that house thing. So that was a matter of make a big difference, not a little incremental one.
And like we can see examples of that, especially with CCG games today, and like having the different factions, or like if you're playing Hearthstone, the Mage, Druid, etc. And they each have those.
They are really different. Yeah,
and they have those big changes. And again, like you can, it's kind of fun when you like talk about like how crazy those abilities get. And again, we could spend who knows how long on that one topic, but it's the same thing as you just said, Sandy, that like the big changes are the ones that players are going to notice. If it was only like, let's,
it gives them stuff to talk about, you know. Someone said, right? And I tried to do this in Orcs Must Die, not right, with the player characters feel really different. Mm-hmm. and their super abilities feel different. And some of the characters are really good at annihilating a single enemy, and some of them are really good at going general damage over a bunch. Some are more support characters. And the idea is I'm trying to make the players all be viable, but all feel different, and not in a matter of, well, let's see, we have to have one tank and one DPS and one healer, but more a matter of, okay, we have this thing, and there's three different guys who all can do support. Let's support each other and use that to win. It wouldn't work in an MMO, but it works in Orcs Must Die because of the nature of the characters. And so you can have so if you're playing a game where everyone is a support character, you can still beat the orcs, but it feels really differently than if you're all playing brutes.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good form of that design. Again, like, it's keeping it from being, like, as you said, like, with an MMO, that MMOs tend to become very, like, pigeonholed in terms of, like, the classes and stuff you need. Like, if you're going to, like, a raid in WoW, you know exactly
Looking for priests, right? Looking for DPS, need a tank, in general chat.
Whoever says looking for DPS.
No one's ever looking for DPS, but they are looking for tanks and stuff, right? So it's like, so you have to fill in the slots in your Lego, in your little, Tetris puzzle before you can go on the adventure. And, you know, there's a place for that, but when you can mix up anything, then I think there's especially because if you play the game with a bunch of guys in there, and of course, when anyone plays Orcs Must Die for the first time, they always want to be the bruiser. They want to be Temper or one of the big tough guys, because, hey, they're tough, right? Or a spellcaster, because those are tough too. And then later on, they say, hey, let's try one of these other characters and see what they can do. And then when they play the other characters, suddenly the game feels totally different to them. And they may take a while to figure out how to win with them because they're so different. They can't just go in there and brawl, you know? Well, that's cool because it means that they effectively got to play a whole new game using the same set, you know, which I like, you know?
Yep, definitely. And again, like, being able to, like, feel out, like, these different units or different mechanics like that is a great way to get someone invested in that kind of design. And, like, as you said, like,
of course, there's randomizing elements. Go ahead.
What I was about to say was, like, we can see the same with, like, RPGs and other, like, titles where they'll start you off with, like, a beginner unit or, you know, something that is just very easy to play with just to get you into it, and then they'll unlock, you know, more advanced mechanics or more advanced characters you can try and sort of, like, to try to wean you off to do something else in that game.
Yes, I have seen games that did that and even that did it effectively. It's not really my technique, because whenever I buy a game that tries to ease me into playing it, I am always resentful and I would jump in with both feet, whether or not that's good for me. So I kind of want to have the things. I mean, I do add options in the game to where, hey, when you've had fun playing the game enough, you can add this challenge. But they're always clearly a challenge, not like you're only playing the baby version of the game. Later on, you get the real one.
You're paying the light version of this, and, you know, come back in an hour, we can do the real one. I know. I like that whole thing, you know, the real game begins, you know, 5-10 hours, and that stuff just drives me crazy when I see games.
Oh, I hate that. Yeah, if a game isn't fun, like, 30 seconds in, why am I why don't I play something else that is fun 30 seconds in,
you
know?
Yeah, definitely.
I just want it to be fun right from the start. Now, it can be a different kind of fun. Yeah. Like, when you're playing Age of Empires, the first thing you do is you have a house and you have some villagers, and like, what can I do? Oh, look, I can hunt a wild pig. Oh my gosh, it's attacking me! You know, and then you're having fun doing that. And then later on, of course, the fun is sending in your Hussars to exterminate the enemy of my population. But right at the start of that game, you're doing things that are fun. So I wanted Orcs Must Die. So the very first thing, you don't spend a long time building up. Right off the bat, there's orcs walking in that are at least a potential threat to your existence, and you can immediately start killing them and doing things. You know, which is and in fact, one of the features I have in the game to help make people feel like they're part or choice and start is that the characters have this thing I call their ultimate, and it's like this super, like, the big red button that each character can push that does something fabulous. Okay? And, you know, it might make them explode, or it might kill all the enemies in an area, or it might rain pennies from heaven or something, right? and these these ultimates can be refreshed, but it's hard to do. And typically, you mainly do your ultimate once, maybe twice in a whole game. Okay? And so one of the choices people have once they've experienced is like, huh, maybe I should fire my ultimate off really early and bootstrap myself up, or maybe I should save it for a later point. But the point is that early on, from the very start of the game, they're thinking about the ultimate, even though it's this, mm-hmm. this super giant power, because like, should I do it now? Should I do it later? Mm-hmm. If I do it now, you know, and then that becomes an interesting decision instead of just, boy, I can't wait till I get that ultimate I can use.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, definitely. And there's always that. It's always fun when we start coming up with like those ideas for like the ultimate power that, you know, like for fans of Command Conquer, the super weapon, that thing that's going to just wreck the game, but you have to know exactly when to use it. And
yes,
I guess that's an interesting question I just want to ask you about, Sam. This may be a little bit of a tangent, but when you're thinking about things like that, like the ultimate, you know, quote unquote, ultimate skill, ultimate power, that game breaking ability, like, again, like, when you're thinking of something like that, you could think of, you know, anything and everything that you could imagine for being the ultimate power. But as a designer, whether it's video game or tabletop, how do you, like, try to balance something that you know is supposed to be, like, game-breaking, in a sense?
Well, if it's a multiplayer game like Cthulhu Wars, then I try to balance it. One of my things about balance, there's two different ways to balance yeah. things. Okay, there's three different ways to balance things. Oh, no, take it back. Go back. We'll back out to two. One is to have everyone kind of be the same. So, like, chess is yeah. balanced because both sides have the same powers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And every time that you balance something by, I don't know if other, we used to say nerfing it mm-hmm. at Ensemble yeah. Studios, and I think, well, like if something is nerfed, it's like made weaker, right? Every time we balance something by making it weaker, that's a step towards everyone being the yeah. same. Okay? So whenever I can, and I admit I can't always do this, I try to balance something by having by not weakening the guy who has the overpowered ability, but by upgrading the yeah. other players.
Mm-hmm.
So they are so everyone feels overpowered.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all feel powered. Now, in the case of a co-op game, I was trying to make all the players feel like they had a cool, unique, awesome game-breaking ability, and the way I balanced that was by having the monsters be so mean that you had to have these to be able to win. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the most common ways beginning players lose Orcs Must Die is by saving their ultimates and never not using them until too late, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. which actually kind of works for me mentally, because what happens is they play the game and they lose and they say, man, I never did my ultimate. And then they're like, oh, but if I had... And then next game they play, they're like, mm-hmm. you know, they've learned.
Yes. Now, another part of Orcs Must Die that I want to touch on, as you said, like as we said a few minutes ago, with the original version, it didn't have the multiplayer. And then after you release the Orcs version, then you can combine both games together to get sort of like this PvP kind of thing going along.
Yeah. Yeah.
My question for you is, when you were first designing the original version of Orcs Must Die, did you have that idea in the back of your head to do, like, that kind of PvP, or did it kind of, like, grow while you were, like, iterating and releasing the different versions?
My original idea was that I would just have two versions of the game to pick which one I wanted to do. And then, through feedback from the guys at Robot, they said, you should go head to head and have PvP. And I said, oh, but it's going to be so hard to balance and figure out. And it's way easier to balance a single, like a co-op game, you know, yeah. when I was all whiny. And I said, okay, but they said, but it'd be really cool. And then the thing is, I couldn't argue against the statement that it would be really cool.
Yeah.
Right. So I said, okay, we're going to try to do this. And so I tried to put it together and I decided that the easiest way to do it is kind of make it symmetrical in a sense, not that it's evenly balanced, but two ways to do it could be that one team would play totally different from the other and they would be escorting the orcs into the rift. Mm-hmm. Well, that wasn't going to work for Orcs Must Die because even without enemy players, the orcs still have a pretty good chance of winning, right? So you really can't just have enemies plus orcs going up against the human players unless you did some kind of big imbalance where there's a lot more humans or something. Or orcs, vice versa. The other possibility is that each of you had your own fort, and each of you were defending it as well as attacking, and then you have something interesting going on. And then the other feature that came out of it was I noticed that there was a change in the game's process, which is that when you're playing the rivalry game, usually the game ends in the second level instead of going on to the end of the third. It actually, the game takes about the same length of time to play because it takes twice as long to play with twice as many players, mm-hmm. right? But it doesn't. But it only lasts about half. But it only lasts half as many turns
because
mm-hmm. the game ends earlier. And I'm fine with that. You know, it's a quick, tight game where one or two decisions can or a few lucky rolls can overthrow it. And I, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. I think
definitely.
And then, of course, the funny thing that happened is that after we'd done this for a while, and just when I finally got our rivalry game working, so it was taking the right amount of time and everything was balanced, it was all fun, then Robot decided it was too hard to balance their own PvP version, and they yanked it out of their game. And they didn't have it anymore. So I still had it in my board game. And I said, well, what? And after they had nagged me to put it in, and I said, well, I'll just keep it, you know, because it's cool. We'll just have something that you don't have.
And we were talking about this before we started the podcast, about how the board game differs from the video game. Are there any other major differences in terms of the design?
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of other major differences. Like, for example, when I brought out when I gave the copies of the game to the guys at everyone at Robot got a copy of the game, mm-hmm. right? So I'm bringing them their copy of the game, and I lay it down. Look at this. Here's the awesome. And right on the front cover, there's this character, Sir Winston, the anti-paladin. And they said, oh, he's not in our game anymore. I said, oh, well, he's in ours. And they actually had a bunch of heroes that they yanked from the game for either because they couldn't balance them or because they're going to save them for a later release. And then we actually got dinged on this because there was like six of these characters that were based on things that they were planning to put into the game that we thought they'd have. And then they said, you can't use the art for any of these characters because, we're not going to officially release them we're keeping them secret in the computer game. So what I did was I said, well, what art can I use for them? And they let me use skins. Now, you know what a skin is in a video game. Right. So I used skin, like the most extreme skins I could get of other characters. But so like, for example, one of them is like the Scarecrow. It's the War Mage, but he looks like a Scarecrow. He's a pumpkin head. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I used the skin for the figures for our game, but I didn't use the stats for the War Mage for the skin. I used the stats for one of the creatures was like a chameleon. Okay, and I took the chameleon stats and used that for the skin. So the characters that are skins are completely unlike their parent mm-hmm. character in the game. They have really, really different abilities. Some of them change shape and they do all kinds of things, right? Because they're based on the original figures that they were going to let me use, which were water elementals and all these weird things, you know, gnomes and stuff. So I kept those stats. That way I didn't have to rebalance them because I didn't want to rebalance them all. Because I loved the creatures I had. Everyone loved playing these figures. I just couldn't use the art because of marketing issues from them coming down on me and saying, you can't use this art. Mm-hmm. So then people got mad at me because, oh, you're letting them kill your characters. I tried to explain that the characters are still there. All the gameplay is the same as it was. Just instead of having a figure of a water elemental, you'll have a scarecrow. Mm-hmm. But not everyone was able to understand that. And in fact, the guys at Ensemble, when I brought it by, they were looking at the characters and say, oh, this is the Bride of Frankenstein skin of the Sorceress. Mm-hmm. So you have two different characters. The Sorceress, as I know, the Bride character in the game is not at all like the Sorceress. She has totally different abilities. And they go, really? And they thought that was cool when they understood it. But because the idea of a skin is so common in video games and so alien to a board game, mm-hmm. right, and I didn't really use them as skins. I used them as a different character, and so that was kind of hard for them to comprehend.
That is interesting. And like for those of you listening, I know the second Orcs Must Die Unchained. No, that's the third game. I'm saying has gone through some major changes. I've been checking it out, and I mean, hell, that could be. I would love to talk to someone about Robot, talk to someone from Robot about kind of like that evolution, because I know it's caused some very diverse of topics from a lot of people.
Oh, yeah, I've noticed mm-hmm. that. And in fact, they've taken so long in producing the game, and of course, when they discarded PvP, they put the best face on it they could, but ultimately, to a player, that's just going to look bad.
Oh, yeah, duh.
Even if it was a wise idea for them to mm-hmm. do, for many reasons, it's not going to, I mean, a player is always going to hate not having PvP, mm-hmm. right? So, and of course, on the other hand, because we got delayed in production of Orcs, I mean, it's out now, right? But we didn't get it out as soon as we originally planned to. It was kind of good for us that they delayed in doing Unchained, because that way we weren't releasing our game 8 months after the board game hit the bricks, you know? So, in fact, we're out before them.
Nice.
So we are awesome. And,
all right. I know we are.
Now we're going to release it all again.
Yeah, awesome. I think that's a good lead. And then to our final topic, I know we are just about to hit an hour. So I figure we'll spend maybe 10, 15 minutes on the Kickstarter for the sequel. And then I think that will take us to the end for the cast for today. So, with that said, of course, as we said at the beginning of the cast, you are planning on doing a Kickstarter for... Now, is this going to be a full-on sequel to Orcs Must Die, or is this will be like an expansion to Orcs Must Die?
This is a expansion to Orcs Must Die. You need Orcs Must Die to use these things.
Okay. You say Orcs...
This is not... So, it's Orcs Must Die 2 only in that... It is our second Kickstarter of Orcs Must Die. It's really Orcs Must Die, like, level 2, like their second wave or something.
Can someone play with, like, the Orcs version? Like, is, like, either the Orcs or the Order version, like, equal?
Either one will use these. Okay. So what we have in it is that there are... We've added two heroes, one for the Order, one for the Unchained. And one of the dirty little secrets of Orcs Must Die is that, in fact, you can take an Unchained hero and play it alongside the Order co-op, and it doesn't break the game. It works out, you know, or mix and match freely and have some Order and some Unchained on each side fighting. It might be a little harder to figure out who's who, because the Unchained guys are green and the Order guys are blue, but as long as you can remember which figure is yours, you can do it. So there's an Order, and these characters, again, because they didn't give us new heroes in the game, they're skins of old heroes, but they have completely different abilities than the old heroes. So one of them is the God of Plunder, who's based on Hogarth, okay? But he's nothing like Hogarth. He doesn't fight like Hogarth. He's just different from Hogarth, but he has these cool abilities where he's able to loot and get extra money because he's the God of Plunder, right? So I kind of ripped off his name. And the other is the Royal Pain, who's based on the Cobalt King. And I wanted to use him because I think the Cobalt King looks really cool, and the Royal Pain looks really cool, too. So I just wanted to have a guy. And then the Royal Pain is interesting because he has the ability, what he uses, his ability is to choose one of three possible actions. And uniquely in the game, he can damage your own rift for benefits that he gets. So it's like no one else does that. So he's kind of in that way. So the other things I've added in the game is I wanted to make sure the game is as useful. So in theory, if you're a purist and you only had one of the two games, you couldn't use one of these two heroes. Okay. But what you can do now, the minions in the game are all general minions that work for both sides. They're enemies of everyone. Okay. And they're going to be their own special color. So you can remember, and one of the things that's kind of cool about them is that if you run out of one of these minions, then right now the way the game works is if you run out of a certain minion, you replace it with like other minions. But because these are shared, so if you're playing the rivalry game and you run out of Thunderbats, because you have all the Thunderbats on one guy's map, the other guy doesn't have Thunderbats appear anymore because there's none left in the pool. So he loves that. Yeah, you know Thunderbats. So you kind of want to keep these things trimmed down so the other guy is able to have them spawn on his pool. Which is an interesting new feature in the game. The other thing we've added to the game are guardians, because the game has guardians. I got them from the idea of the game. In the game, you can get these huge warrior creatures that stand by your rift and kill. They're like a super trap that can fight. So I've added these. And the thing is, I've made them cost a lot. So basically, if you get one of these guardians, it sort of costs you one of your renewals, which is how you get your ultimates back. So you're sort of giving up everyone's ultimate one use of it in exchange for this guardian, it's kind of ultimately it makes the game easier for players simply because it's a new option you have that defensively. But the game has, I don't know if you've looked at the game's list of maps, but the maps go from like easy, moderate, hard, nightmare, hell level maps. Okay. And so you can, if you say, well, the game's easier because I'm using guardians, you can say, well, instead of playing it hard, play it at the nightmare level and it'll be plenty hard still. Okay. And the game also has other techniques in it to increase the you add bosses to make it tougher. And we've added new bosses. And the new bosses are actual bosses that they've recently added to the game. Bull God, Gatebreaker, Grenwald, and like that. So these are fun, fun enemies and here's the fact. I haven't been playing the most recent version of Orcs Must Die, so I have no idea what these bosses do in Orcs Must Die. I've just given them fun things to do in the board game and not cared about what they do in Orcs Must Die. One of them is called Gatebreaker, which means he really pounds through your gate. But since there's no gates in my board game, he can't do that. You know? So he does something else. And but I'm okay with that, because now Orcs Must Die, the board game, has kind of taken on its own existence outside of the computer game. It's not just a little interesting add-on or something you can play if you don't want to play the computer game at the moment or the net's down. It's a thing in its own right that you play and have fun with, which is how it should be, really.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely. And it's a very interesting talking to you over the last hour about how the board game, it started out being growing from the video game, but it has really taken on its own life and its own kind of design over the first, second, and then with what you're playing with the Kickstarter.
Sure, and that works. It works both ways. If you have a computer game that's based off a board game, then typically you want, like, why would you do that unless you could take advantage of some computer aspects to make it more interesting? You know, to add, you know. So, I think that it should go both ways. That computer games should change board games when they go onto the computer game, and that, you know, and vice versa. So,
yeah. And like we've been seeing some kind of like headway with that, at least in the last few months or maybe the last few years, with how we've been seeing more games based on the Warhammer universe brought over to the PC. I know there was also, there was a Space Hulk game that came out, I think, a few months ago as well. And,
oh man, I loved Space Hulk back in the day.
And it is interesting to see, like, about taking these elements. As we said earlier, like, when you were translating mechanics and systems from Orcs Must Die, the video game, to the tabletop, you decided you wanted to make sure to keep to a very fast-paced game, keep that core gameplay loop streamlined like that, which meant, of course, again, changing things to make it fit to the tabletop. And, like, when we see things go the other way around, it'll be curious to see if designers, like, as I think we talked about this last time, about possibly seeing more tabletop games have digital versions, if tabletop designers will change things around if they ever decide to make a digital version of their game.
I mean, you've summed it up really well.
Thank you.
That's precisely what it needs to be like. The thing is, both formats have strengths, okay? And if they are not using every aspect of their strengths and discarding everything that would be a weakness taken over from the other way of doing games, then you're not maximizing the fun for the players.
Yep.
You know, as just one example, in my game Cthulhu Wars, one of the features of that game that's really fun that you can't get in a computer version of it is that when you summon Cthulhu, have you played Cthulhu?
No,
Wars?
I have not, sadly.
Okay, when you summon Cthulhu, you get this 8-inch tall behemoth of a figure that you slam down on the tabletop, and everyone at the table kind of stops for a second and catches their breath because, like, oh man, Cthulhu's in the wheelhouse now, right? That's something that is hard to get in a computer game. Maybe occasionally something like it when you're playing a World of Warcraft and some really gigantic boss appears, but it's not the same as when you're playing it on the table yourself. Look what I've got. I've got this thing. And that's something that the board game does, and that I was able to pull off by having the giant figure, you know? And of course, there's the panoply of seeing the whole board at once, which is harder to do in a computer game, especially when you're doing like first or third person view. You can only see what's in around you right now. You don't get to see the big picture the same way. And the board game lets you have that big picture, which is
definitely.
Wait, that's my anderings on the topic.
Okay. Like I said, I think we will begin to wrap things up. And when we say goodbye, just hang on for like a few minutes. I just want to ask you a few like post-cast questions. But I guess to begin to wrap things up, I guess the first question then for you is, regarding like Orcs Must Die or translating a video game to a tabletop, were there any like topics that we didn't touch on that you would like to bring up now?
One of the topics that makes it more awkward to do a video game and a computer game is that, in general, video game companies have zero idea of what it takes to do a board game. And so when you're trying to negotiate a contract with them or like money with them, or how things need to work out and go back and forth, they have, sometimes they have unrealistic expectations, mm-hmm. or they are like, well, you have to have it done by this time, or they don't necessarily get the, what your challenges are. So that is an issue that is actually, you have to sort of educate them on, and you have to do it without saying, well, you guys are ignorant because you don't know there's this and this and this. And, like, for example, here's a very simple difference. When you're doing a computer game and you finally finish your gold master at the end of the process, it's really fast to produce that thing, right? I mean, the slowest part of the process is printing the manuals, assuming you even have manuals, right? If you're putting it on Steam, who cares? This is out, right? So once you're done, the game is instantly in people's pockets, in people's hands, okay? Well, when I finish a board game, it's going to be months before people get the game, because we have to make the resin masters, and we have to make steel injection molds. We have to the printing of the manual is one of the quicker parts of the process. Plus, then the game has to be collated into boxes. And here's this game that has like 50 figures, Orcs Must Die, per box, and you have to have the right number of each figure. You know, you can't have more than one master in each figure, or it'll be wrong. And masters are the characters. It sounds like, right? And so you have, and then everything has to be stuffed in the number, they have one card of each type in the deck, all the kind of stuff. So there's all this preparation, and there's months and months, and that's something that you kind of have to, like, explain to in such a way that you're not sounding arrogant, because, of course, the other thing is that they, in the video game company, they are making vast more money gross than you are. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, individually, we profit similarly because, Robot makes way more money, millions and millions of dollars, far more than Peterson Games makes, but Robot has like 70 or 80 people working there, and Peterson Games has 5. So proportionally, we do fine individually, but they are so much bigger, and when they're saying, well, how many copies of this game are you going to do? And we say, well, it's not going to be 100,000, it's going to be like 8,000 games. They kind of, really? how does that make money for us? And they probably wouldn't have done it except the fact that they love and trust me, and we're excited to see their game. So part of the thing was financially they didn't. I mean, they made money off it, right? They didn't cost them anything, and they made a little bit of money, but it's a tiny amount of money proportioned to their needs. Okay, so the main perk for them was that they get to have these cool plastic figures of their monsters and their heroes. These cool looking board games, so the game had to look as opulent and lush. So it was fortunate they're doing Peterson Games, that's kind of our thing, right? To make opulent, lush games. So that was all, you know, kind of how it went down. That the fairy dust is kind of how I got them to agree to the product. Not by saying, oh, well, this game's going to make you $1 million. We had to go, this game is going to be really cool for all your. And so the part of the deal was, I said, that everyone in the company got a copy of the game. And they loved that. That was like a huge company meeting where they all showed up and they each picked out their game and all their expansions. And they were so excited to see it all. And they were playing with little skulls and they were admiring the figures. And they hadn't seen figures like this very often. And they were, look at the little tiny hand that has all the fingers. And they were just admiring the stuff. And really, the figures, I mean, we didn't find figures, but there's plenty of companies that do figures as good as we do. Okay. It's just that the video game, that the guys at Robot were kind of ignorant of what the industry standard was. I didn't exploit them. They got their reward. They got their cool stuff. Everyone gets to have a figure of their favorite, the War Mage, to glue to the top of their monitor or whatever they want, right? But, so those are kind of there's like this whole cultural thing going back and forth that has to work. Now, it helped a little bit because a number of the guys at Robot are dedicated board gamers. Not board game designers, you understand, but board gamers. So those guys helped, you know, say, yeah, these are cool. So,
very interesting. Again, like the topic of, again, like the logistics of designing a board game is certainly a very fascinating one. And as you said, Sandy, for people who aren't into like tabletop gaming or tabletop designers themselves, it's not something that you would generally think about. And I've spoken to several developers in the past who have worked on either tabletop games in general or just like a card game, and they've also echoed similar statements about that challenge when it comes to the logistics side of getting everything printed up and making sure everything is proper.
Yeah, it's a big deal. I mean, we literally fly members of our team to China to watch shepherd them through the process. And what we've discovered is that when someone goes there to check up, I'm not saying that the Chinese are all slackers or anything, but when someone goes there, things go a lot more smoothly and things are done a lot more effectively, and little fixes happen that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So the fact that they know you come to kind of keep them, to watch over them is, I recommend it to every company that works with China. Fly your dude there and look at the factory.
Mm-hmm, yep.
That's something you don't do to these two games.
Definitely. All right. I guess another wrap-up question for you. As I said at the beginning, we are recording this at just about the start of April. When are you planning on doing the Kickstarter for the Orcs Must Die expansion?
It's going to be launched near the end of April. Right. So it'll probably be happening during May, mostly.
Cool. All right. And then I guess one of my last questions then for you is, as we said before the cast, you are planning on, you have several other projects in the works throughout 2017. And like we said, if things go accordingly, we would definitely have you back on to talk about them. But for the folks listening to this right now, if you give them a little bit of like a teaser about what's coming next from Pearson Games, feel free.
Okay. Well, in rough order of what is coming out this year only, I'm talking about, we have Onslaught 3 for Cthulhu Wars, which has new factions, new great old ones, new creatures, new map for Cthulhu Wars, plus reprinting the game, which has become ever scarcer in stores. Then we have a board game called Evil High Priest, which is a worker placement game about releasing your great old one from the depths. And the cool thing about it is that every time you play on a different map because each map is its own great old one. So when you're releasing Cthulhu, the game is completely different from when you're releasing the Opener of the Way.
Cool.
And that's kind of a cool feature I haven't seen a lot in the worker placement games. And the other thing we're doing this year that is my big push is Planet Apocalypse, which is a cooperative game about the end of the world, sort of a cross between Fury Road and Doom. It's after the Holocaust with demons going over the world from the Book of Revelation, and you have to go shoot them down.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking about that last one just before the cast. That one is going to be strictly co-op, I think you said, right?
That is strictly co-op. And the reason it's strictly co-op is because that way I can make the demons just as gross and hard to beat and terrifying as I need to.
Nice.
I don't have to balance them. They're just awful. So when you win this game, you feel like you've been through the ringer, and this game always goes down to the wire if you win. It's like if one more demon had escaped, we would have lost. If they killed one more of us, they would, right? But we barely got one more turn, we would have lost is how it always ends. So that's exciting.
Awesome. Good luck with everything. And like I said, definitely want to catch up with you about each one of those topics throughout 2017.
Okay.
All right. So with that said, we're going to end things here for today's cast. Again, Sandy, thank you so much for coming on. Good luck with the Kickstarter for Orcs Must Die and for the other projects as well.
Thank you.
All right. So with that said, I guess my final question for you for this evening then is, do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to the fans before we hang up for today?
Caught me by surprise. I guess I would say stay safe. Don't text while you're driving.
And tip your waiters. Tip your waiters.
And tip your waiters. I always do that. Unless the waiter does something super dramatic. Like spill a plate of beans on my lap. But then I let them know that I'm unhappy, right? So.
All right. All right. So.
Also, don't blame your waiter for mistakes the kitchen does. It's not his fault.
Definitely. All right, I think with those important life lessons, we will wrap things up for today. So,
Again,
be sure to check out the Orcs Must Die board game, as well as the upcoming Kickstarter. When you have a chance, Andy, feel free to send those links over, and I'll be sure to include them in the notes for people to enjoy below. And with that said, hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have multiple options available. First, if you would like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future guest for any of our discussions, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBicer for updates throughout the day. We are on Twitch at same thing, GWBicer, for mostly daily streams and sometimes live developer interviews. And the Game Wisdom YouTube channel, now over 1,500 subscribers strong at the time of this recording. Be sure to check us out for daily vlogs and discussions on all manner of video games. And last but not least, our Patreon campaign. You can find us on Patreon under Game Wisdom or GW Bicer. Donations will help to keep things going. As we hit more of our goals, it will mean more content for everyone to enjoy. So again, Sandy, thank you so much for hanging out with me this afternoon. And I'll be more than happy to talk with you later on.
Okay, great.
All right.
Take care.
You too. So again, for those of you listening, thanks for tuning in. And we will catch you all next time. Take care.